Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello, my name is Gary Mansfield, and this is the Ministry of Arts podcast, where each week I'll be speaking to a different artist. Now let's begin by bagging these bongos. Hello. We're over 4 years into the podcast and I still smile every time I hear that tune. Firstly, as ever, a big shout out to our Patreon supporters, without whom we would not be able to produce this podcast. And if you think you'd like to support the podcast, then head over to our Patreon page or go over to the Ministry of Arts Instagram profile. You'll see a Linktree drop-down box that will direct you straight to the Patreon page. And you can support us for as little as £3 a month, which is pretty much a cup of coffee. And if not, that's absolutely fine. This content is free for everyone. Well, today I'm taking you to meet Steve Lowe. Steve is the head honcho over at L13. Yeah, L13 to me are a whole different part of the art world, along with others like Kennard Phillips, Flying Leaps, and several other groups, organisations or individuals that are just different. They're nonconformists, adjutants to authority, or whatever you'd like to call them. Many want to make a statement or try to make a statement, but people like these that I've just mentioned, they don't want to make a statement. They've got a fucking manifesto. And we previously spoke to Kennard Phillips. We're about to speak to L13 and Aid from Flying Leaps. Agreed to come on some time ago and I've just got a pinion down. But anyway, back to Steve Lowe and L13. And I don't think anyone can describe L13 as good as L13 does itself. It's a private ladies and gentlemen's club for art, leisure and the disruptive betterment of culture. They state that they are not a gallery, a publisher, nor do they represent artists. And they are most definitely not an art collective. The key artists currently active with L13 are Harry Adams, Jimmy Courtney, Billy Childish and Jamie Reed, all of whom I'm sure the authorities would describe as a disruptive pain in the arse. Rightly so. Well, just a short while ago I was invited down to the L13 bunker and I had a pile of questions to ask Steve. So we sat down over a cup of tea, press record, and I asked away. And because this episode turned out to be just under an hour and a half, I've decided to cut it into two and divide them over a couple of days. Although if you're a Patreon supporter, shoot over to our Patreon page, that'll be sitting there waiting for you. So please, come and join me down in the L13 bunker, speaking to Steve Lowe.
You know, until sometimes till the early hours of the morning.
Yeah.
And I work with Adam, you know, so I working collaboration with Adam, so you know. So all these are our paintings. It used to be much more toxic down here.
You know, what, the environment?
In every single way. But you know, because we were doing oil paintings and also using beeswax and caustic.
So you knew where you were when you walked through the door.
But we keep on talking about getting back to painting. Hopefully we'll make it this year. So it's, the
first that we are actually launching something on Tuesday. We'll probably make an announcement tomorrow, giving the details. But it's an exhibition. Me and Adam when we started out. I met Adam at art college. And we went to the Barham Shaw School of Art, which is now part of Central St Martin's. Yeah. Back then it was an independent. And we actually started working together because he wanted to start a band. And he was involved in the student union. And we started this band together. And we scared everybody off because, you know, we just into making noise. And we started doing these performances. We described it as Ein Stenzer Neubert and without the tunes, you know, just like, and just creating a lot of mayhem. We were we'd get up really early in the morning to go there to work in the basement and make this horrific noise that we got into trouble various times over doing, you know. It's like we'd mic everything up and we managed to break the goods lift by short-circuiting everything so we could have the doors open, had speakers in the shaft. So that's where I met Adam. Then we were in bands. I ended up going to Belfast to do an MA, but left about a month before the end. And it's partly because I kept on coming back to London to rehearse for this band that we were starting. Yeah. And I was trying to tell them, well, can't the band be part of my MA? And they weren't having any of it. You know, it's like, you know, that's different from visual art. So in the end, I don't want to do the final show.
Did you regret that afterwards or not?
No, I've never. The only time I regret it was when my ex-wife, she was a jeweler, and she went back to college and got, because she never did a degree, so she finished her degree. She got a degree and then she went straight on to do an MA and then got an MA. And that was the only time I thought, hang on, I want an MA. I could have had an MA,
but you stole my fun.
You know, it's a bit like my school qualifier. I actually did quite well with O levels. Sort of decided I was going to be an artist, so I didn't really bother that much with A levels. But I've never shown anybody my qualifications ever. So
I don't even remember getting mine from school.
Yeah, you know, I think in this line of work, it's just, even when I did my MA, I turned up the portfolio, they never checked to see, you know, what my paper qualifications were.
Yeah, I know a few years ago, the galleries were recommending that artists do an MA.
Yeah.
If they hadn't got one, they wanted it as part of their portfolio, if you like.
Yeah, I mean, I think it just, you know, it's like a CV thing. It's like that idea that you're somehow more qualified. But, you know, as Billy probably said, I always found that my experience at art college was, I really liked it because you were just with a few like-minded people. I was actually shocked how few like-minded people there were. But, you know, just meeting somebody like Adam, and we were able to do stuff that we wanted to do in a way that we wanted to do it. And, you know, and we had a lot of freedom to do that. But, you know, in terms of them teaching you anything, that's highly questionable.
And how was the band? Was it worth leaving uni for at the time? Well, time it was.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so when I left, I think I even said to, it was Alistair McLennan, who was the head of course, and I said, and he gave me a bit of an ultimatum. He said, stay in Belfast and, you know, do some work. And, you know, and I said, yeah, actually, I think I'll leave. And then they spent 4 years trying to get me to go back because I had the only English grant. There were kids there from Scotland, Ireland.
Yes.
And I got the only grant that England gave to go there, and so they couldn't be seen to have wasted that. Yeah. So they were trying to get me to go back and for 4 years. They kept asking me to go and do the final show. So just do the final show, and you'll get your MA. And I always refused. And the reason I refused was because I didn't want to end up being an art tutor. And I knew that if I got that qualification, I'd be able to go and get a job as an art tutor, which would be really well paid in comparison to anything else I could get. And the idea of being an art tutor pulled me so much, I would rather starve.
Not take the chance,
be tempted. So,
superb.
And I said to Alistair McLennan, so, you know, I'm leaving because I, I, I hate art and I hate all artists. So I really don't, you know, I don't want anything to do with it anymore. Yeah. Which is really good because since I was probably about 14, all I'd wanted to do was be an artist.
Yeah.
But at the time, I think I was just more into music. With music, you can get on stage, and even if you're playing to 20 people, two people, they're so much more engaged with what you're doing. We did our mid-term show in Belfast, and you know, so we all presented our work, and we did an exhibition, and you know, about half a dozen people turned up, and they, you know, nobody cares, and whereas you know, you go and play a gig, and people are engaged. Yeah. And, you know, well, I thought this was much more, you know, something that I can relate to.
Well, that's the thing with any exhibition. You've got the opening night, which is the big night, and then we walk away from it as an artist and just hope that other people go in before it gets taken down again.
Yeah. Now, you know, working back in art, I still find it weird. I'm trying to always gauge what it is that people are interested in what we do and how interesting I am, because there's... it's so complicated with the people to, you know, the number of people say, I only like what I like, you know, I'm not interested in investment, I'm not interested in what it's worth. But they are.
I agree.
And that doesn't exist in the music. I mean, obviously, if you're collecting records now, you know, it's like, you know, some of those are becoming worth a bit of money. But in terms of going to gigs, you're having a proper engagement with that artist, making, you know, doing what they do. And all of that had so much of a big impact on me than anything in the art world.
Yeah.
And, you know, I suppose when I was younger, I had a more romantic ideal of what it would mean to be an artist. And I love creativity, but the art world is still a mystery to me. I just don't really...
And in all that time, has it become more of a mystery, or have you got the... Just as you think you've got the hang of it, something.
The only difference now between when I was younger, when I decided that I didn't want to be involved with the art world, and now is that I don't care anymore.
Is that an age thing now?
I think it is. Yeah. You know, when you're younger and you want to change the world, or you want to do something which, you know, is going to, you know, have impact.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't the medium for me, and I'm still very suspicious of why people are interested in art. You know, it still seems to me that anybody actually involved in it has a vested interest. So if you go to private view, you'll find a lot of other artists there. I mean, it'd be like going to a gig and it all being musicians.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't happen. You know, it's or art dealers or people trying to get in on something, particularly if it's successful. You know, if it's unsuccessful, it's...
Why is it you go to a private view?
I try not to.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, so the only ones I will go to tend to be when they are a friend or somebody I know or one of Billy's. You know, so
I like the way that you put Billy in a separate category from friends or someone you know.
Well, but if I wasn't working with Billy, then and he was my mate, then I might not. You know, I'll probably go to his opening. I never, you know, I'm a little bit shy and socially awkward anyway. So the idea, I was never into networking.
Yeah.
And couldn't do
I
that.
I find that difficult.
Yeah.
Although everyone presumes that I find it easy because I sort of work my way in everywhere by just asking, because most of the time people don't like to ask, but I'm okay with that. Yeah. You know? So it seems to work okay. But the Steve Lowe of today, the question that I have that I ask each artist is, how would you describe what you do to someone that may not know you or your work?
With great confusion. Yeah. So actually, it was Jamie Reed who first called me an artist, and I told him to fuck off.
When was that?
That would have been about 2004.
Got you.
And I remember being in a cab once and them saying, you know, what is it you do? And I said, I'm an artist, and I felt like such a twat. You know, and so people ask me now, I tend to say I'm mostly a publisher, but I also make art and I work with other artists.
Yeah.
And And then if they say, what do you mean? They say, well, I run a place called the L13 Light Industrial Workshop and private ladies, gentlemen's club for art leisure and the disruptive betterment of culture. Beautiful. And through that, we publish books, we publish prints, we organise exhibitions, we do some fairly major projects. You know, we've toured, you know, kind of Jimmy Carter's containers around the world.
Yeah.
But mostly, I like working with creative people, and I like making things. So really, that's what I do. I work with creative people and I make things.
And have you always wanted a very tight group of creative people? Because you only work with them three mainly.
Yeah. So when I first started and accidentally ended up with a gallery, which I didn't want to be a gallery, and what it was, I was dealing in rare books. I was in a band making no money, so I started off working in the secondhand bookshop, ended up dealing in rare books, and then ended up with a shop just near Euston. And then I started collecting more visual type stuff, and I was really into any counterculture stuff. Yeah. And punk. So I ended up with some posts, and I thought, well, what I should do is start a bit of a gallery area to show some of this more visual stuff. And then that kind of took over from the books. And then I made the mistake of inviting Billy Childish to have an exhibition. So Billy, I called my first artist. It's like having your first kid. And then quite soon after that, we did an exhibition of art it was during the time of the Iraq War. And my business partner at the time was the press secretary for the Stop War Coalition. And a group of them managed to do this, organise an exhibition of art against war, which included people like Banksy, Ralph Steadman, Anthony Caro, David Hamilton. You know, it was like really, you know, quite a big thing. And also Jamie Reid and Jimmy Carter.
Yeah.
They gave work to showing there, and that's how I met them. And it's also how we started doing the printing stuff, because I made a box set for that to raise money for the Stop the War Coalition, which now is very collectible because it's got a Banksy in it.
Super.
That took up several months of my life, because all I had at the time was a desktop printer. And I did an inkjet printer, and there was this little box with 30 prints in each box and 100 boxes. That's 3,000 prints. And I was printing onto paper that you're not supposed to put through a print, you know, cardboard. And you know, so each one had to be individually fed through. So for every night I was there until late, kind
Brilliant.
Of putting these things through. And our share of that fundraiser thing gave us enough money to buy a large format inkjet printer.
Yeah.
And then I asked Jamie if he'd like to do an exhibition, do some prints, and likewise with Jimmy. Jimmy had just been banned from doing the Queen stamps. And I said, well, why did you agree to stop doing those? It's ridiculous. But the trouble is he went to a lawyer, and the lawyer told him that he should do what they say. And I said, well, don't listen to lawyers.
Yeah.
You know, my first project with Jimmy was trying to work out how to do copyright-free stamps of mass destruction with the Queen in a gas mask.
Yeah.
The stamps. And once I'd started working with Jimmy, Jamie and Billy, I thought, actually, you know, why would I want anything else? And I thought, and to my mind, I thought it should be more like an agency. And I said, well, you know, rather than being a gallery, which I don't want to be, where you just have lots of new artists coming and going the whole time and running programmes of exhibitions, why not I just work with a small number of artists and help develop what they do, and we work together to because I always wanted to be a making place as well as a display place. I was really into helping them make things. So with Billy's first show, we did a little kind of poetry book, made a box set of, you know, with the Hangman Gallows, painted it on it with a record in it, and a photograph, and we did little prints. So it was all very, very proactive, which Billy also really liked, because, you know, it's like, rather than just giving some painting and showing, you know, selling a few then handing it back, it was actually more of a relationship.
Because that's three properly powerful names and figures you've got.
Yeah.
And personalities even.
Yes, and at the time, like, so with Billy, even though he was my first artist, when I asked him to do an exhibition, I'd never seen a single one of his paintings.
Oh, really?
And I wasn't interested in his painting. At that point, I was still anti-art.
Yeah.
but I was familiar with his music and his poetry. So I'd come across his written stuff as a book dealer. We used to record at Torag Studios where he'd, you know, there was a whole scene, you know, kind of like
so it's
garage.
You've bought kind of into stuff. The personality.
Well, yeah, or I was interested in their position as, or particularly with Billy to begin with, it was like he's an interesting character on the margins of mainstream culture. I like the music and I like the, actually, it's not even that I like the music or like the poetry. I like the attitude of the music and the poetry.
Yeah.
And then somebody said, oh, you know, he paints as well. I said, yeah, I don't care. And then I saw some of his paintings. My mum used to paint. I thought, oh, they look a bit like my mum's paintings.
Yeah.
You know, they're quite expressionistic. And I said, yeah. Did in doing the prints, making the little book and the box set. And, I really like Billy. Somebody at the time who was involved in the music, he said, don't work with Billy Charles, he's a fucking nightmare. But I was found, like, really, really charming, really engaging.
It depends
engaging.
How capable you are of handling a nightmare.
Well, yeah.
And if you can, then it's fine.
And also, I think he's only a nightmare if you want him to do what you want to do.
Yeah.
But I was just quite happy for him to, I wasn't going to tell him, I'm not interested in your paintings. Oh, yeah, great, you do paintings. Fine, doesn't bother me. You know, so I quite like that one, You know, I wouldn't mind having that on my wall. And it was that simple for me.
Yeah.
But mostly I really liked his attitude towards...
And have you got any of his on your wall?
I've just moved into a new house and I've got one above my desk.
Oh, there you go.
One of my favourite paintings that he gave me. As a birthday present. At home, things haven't gone up on the wall yet, but they're propped up. Well, my partner, Marta, she keeps on saying, well, we should have a Harry Adams on the wall. And I keep on saying, yeah, we should. And I never...
Well, we've spoke about Jimmy, Jamie and Billy and Harry Adams.
Mm-hmm.
Who is Harry Adams and how did Harry Adams come about?
Okay, so Harry Adams is the name that I make paintings under, and I work in collaboration with my friend who I met at art college, Adam Wood, and we were in bands together for years. So I went for about 15 years without being involved in art at all, not going to galleries, just completely not interested. During that time, we made music together, and then when I started working with other artists, it was actually watching Billy. I'd sometimes go to Billy's studio. He had his studio at his mum's house at the time in Whitstable. And occasionally I'd end up there and he'd make me sit and watch him do a painting. and I was watching him down. I thought, actually, when I started art college, I went in as a painter.
Yeah.
I ended up coming out doing kind of more sound-based stuff and installation, orientated. And actually at the time, I loved making books, made artist books. And I was really into the idea of multiples, and the idea of, kind of a democratic art that you can make lots of things. But then when I finished art college, that was it. Wasn't interested anymore and I was in bands. And I met Adam at art college and we collaborated on noise performances. And then when I started working with other artists and thought, actually, it'd be quite good to do a bit of art again. And me and Adam had recorded an album of music under the name of the band at the time was called STOT 21st C Plan B.
Yeah.
I really like awkward long titles.
Did it stand for?
It doesn't really help you to know what it's different. It was Scorpion Thunderbolt of the 21st Century Plan B.
Perfect.
So we did this album and thought, well, look, I've got this gallery space now. Why instead of doing gigs, because we described ourselves as a zero ambition rock band. Well, noise band at the time, so we weren't interested in doing regular gigs or anything anymore because we've been doing it for years and getting nowhere, so we were just doing it for pure pleasure. And so I thought, well, let's do an exhibition to launch it. So we decided we'd have the exhibition, we'd open on my birthday, the 19th of July, and close on Adam's birthday on the 26th of July. And we made all of the work on site in the gallery. We even painted on the walls, we kind of Brilliant. Just made a real mess, and it was all kind of around the ideas in this LP that we'd recorded. And then after that, we kind of got the bug of, kind of making stuff again.
Yeah.
We were still carried on recording for a bit, but eventually the visual art overtook the recording. And that time we went under the name of STOT 21st C Plan B. And the work was very kind of puerile, and a lot of humour, a lot of dark humour, a lot of, it was very anti-art, you know, we'd make stuff, we were just taking the piss, basically, and enjoying us.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And how did it go down with the viewer?
Well, we'd do these exhibitions, we'd always do very well, because we'd sell work for about £3. We would do lots of paint, you know. We thought we'll make it so cheap that they cannot...
They can't not buy it, yeah.
And we did the London Art Fair one time. We had a limited, signed limited edition print for 25p.
Brilliant.
The year before, I'd done an exhibition with Jimmy and Billy. We were always in the arts projects section. I really don't like art fairs, but for some reason I thought we could do art projects, make it a little bit more interesting. So the first one was Billy Childish versus Jimmy Courty. So up to that, I'd kept them apart. So I don't want the artists getting together and ganging up on me. So I thought, well, I'll do this, because I thought, well, the work is quite different. It'd be quite interesting doing an exhibition of Billy's paintings and poetry and
doing like this more. And
for that, we did. Jimmy was making postage stamps at the time, so we did a stamp, and we got on the BBC News because it was the cheapest art in the art fair. Excellent. And it was 50p for a postage stamp.
Oh, man,
so the following year, I thought, we can do better than that. We can do it 25p for a signed limited edition print.
Brilliant.
Which actually relates to, because me and Adam have reformed as SGOT 21st E Plan B, which is the thing we're launching on Tuesday. We're doing an exhibition, which is going to be at the Black Cube Gallery, which is on Fish Island, which is where we used to record our stuff. There's a recording studio there. And Adam took loads of photos of the area before. Fish Island is just by Hackney Wick.
Yeah.
And it's where they all got redeveloped and built up to the Olympics. But Adam would go there at the early hours on grey days and take grim photos when it was just all fly tips and total mess.
Yeah.
And then we made, in about 2007, a series of artworks that showed this kind of scene of apocalyptic scenes, and it was quite inspired by these real life apocalyptic scenes on Fish Island, and we've just revisited that recently. And Adam did most of the work, so I was really busy, but doing these really amazing looking artworks. And now we're going to present it online, because the gallery is called the Black Cube, and it's on Fish Island, and the gallery spaces are built into the subterranean storage tanks of an old petrol processing plant. And the land is so toxic that the authorities would only allow it to be used for showing art. So it's our sort of invented gallery that we're, you know, saying people can't go there because it's still, you know, it's for health and safety reasons.
Excellent.
And also it's very difficult to find.
Yeah.
So, but if people check our website on after Tuesday, there'll probably be a link to the new stock21.com site where the exhibition will be presented and people can learn about the Black Cube. I love storytelling, and I love the idea of that art can be something which is fantastical.
Yes.
And when I was at art college, there was always this talk about everything has to be about the truth. And it always seemed people quite po-faced, and people dealing with issues and, you know, kind of trying to, you know, be very serious about the work. And at the time I was really into an author called Harry Cruz, and he wrote a biography called A Childhood. And in it, he recounts his tale for him getting his first story published in some magazine. He got sent a check, and he was so proud. He went to his mum, and he's from the deep south in America, from a very poor white trash family. And he goes to his mum, "I'm not going to try to do the accent." And he said, "Mum, I've been paid for one of my stories." So what, they're paying me money for those lies? He said, "They're not lies, they're stories." They're lies. And I kind of quite like that. But in the art world, it seemed that you weren't allowed to have that relationship with fiction.
Yeah.
So a lot of what we do, and even with coming up with, and we'll get back to Harry Adams, coming up with the name Harry Adams, is I thought it was a bit more like being in a band. So when you start a band, the first thing you do is, well, what we called.
Yeah.
So when me and Adam decided that we'd stop being SJOT 21st E Plan B and would try and grow up, I said, "Look, Adam, we've got to do some, you know, I've been watching Billy Penny, so I'd really like to do some proper serious painting. And if we do that, we can't be called SJOT 21st E Plan B because we've got this legacy of being idiots. So I want to be taken seriously as an artist." So we thought, well, okay, so what would a serious painter be called? I thought, well, it's got to be sort of an English name.
Yeah.
And also it had to begin with A. So if we were in group shows, we'd be at the top of the list.
Yeah.
And somehow we end up, Harry was my granddad's name. And somehow we ended up with Harry Adams. And we did look at Alexander Adams, but there was my middle name's Alexander, but there's already an Alexander Adams artist exists. So
I hope that's not his real name. I hope he had the same.
Probably completely made up.
Xavier or something.
So we decided we'll be a collaboration, but we'll work under one name. And when we paint, you know, what we make will be Harry Adams paintings. Perfect. And, you know, and the collaboration would work. People would say, well, how do you work together? And so, well, you know, so we've worked together for so long and our egos seem really compatible working. And sometimes we'd both work on the same piece. Sometimes, most often, we'd work on separate pieces. But because of the dialogue, and sometimes I'd copy what Adam was doing, Adam copy what I was doing, if we liked what, you know. So there'd be this relationship in making the work.
Just like a duo in music, yeah.
Exactly. So it's a bit like Lennon McCartney. You know, it's like, but it's still a Beatles song, whether it's written by Lennon or McCartney. Yeah. You get it to the band. You record it; it goes out on the LP as a Beatles record, and that was so. If we decided it was a Harry Adams, it was a Harry Adams, and the identity can change. You know, the band makes can change over time. Yeah. And when we were in a band, we started off as called Buxom, and then we had a number of lineup changes. It was always the core three members, but then we became the Impossible because we had changed direction a bit, and we thought we need to reflect, you know, what the nature of the music is, how the music's changing. So I get, you know, that goes on. But within the art world, it's so linked to this romantic ideal of the lone artist in the garret struggling away, that people really struggle with the idea that it could be a collaborative process. And it's to do with this idea of the lone genius. Yeah. And I've always been I don't believe in genius. I believe in work, you know. Yeah, I believe in working through things, and you know, and you know, I believe people have aptitude.
Yeah, I was going to say some people just find it easier to do something and get listened to more than others might.
Yeah, and also within music, back when I first got really interested in music when I was a young teen, there was a band called Scraping Fetus Off the Wheel, which I was the only person in my school who liked.
And what were they, New Romantic?
He sort of did come out of that. It was around that period, but it was obviously a lot darker, as you can gather from the name, really dark. And he had this thing, it was a lone guy. His real name was Jim Thirlwell. And at the time, you could only find about this stuff by reading the music press and listening to John Peel. Mm. And then buying the record. And I really, really like, but he would talk about, you know, he put the art or the music before him as a personality.
Yeah.
So he would work under various pseudonyms. So Scraping Fetus Fool, Fetus Art Terrorism, and various other fetus monikers, but you never saw photos of him. He said the studio was his instrument, and he just worked alone and played all the instruments and used the studio to create these amazing pieces. And I really like that. I really like the idea of not being visible as the artist. That somehow And it's partly, I used to be really, really shy, and I think it partly comes to that. I don't want people looking at me. And Adam's very the same. Like, we used to have band photos, and Adam would always be at the back in the shadows. And on stage, he'd find the darkest corner to hide in.
Like, at the moment, I mentioned that you're in the bunker, and he's in the bunker at the back
of
the bunker.
Yeah, he's hidden in the room at the back, yeah.
Three bunkers.
So we all have, you know, I think you always tend to work towards what your nature is.
Yeah, so I learned to be loud and funny, or to crack jokes, to make people laugh. Whether I'm funny or not is a different thing, but trying to do that, trying to be a false personality.
Yeah, because there's nothing worse than being a shy person who finds it difficult to engage with other people, but really wanting the attention.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, and I obviously always really wanted the attention. So even when we're a band, I was, not until SGOT, 21st C Plan B, did I become the front person. Then that was very hidden. And I did the singing, I wrote the words and did the singing for that. Although I always describe it as being a band with two lead guitars and drums. But for the other bands, we had this crazy girl called Melanie, who was our singer. And people would say it's her band, and we were going out. We were an item, so it was our band. But I always felt that I was in charge.
Yeah,
I wanted to be one. I was the one in the driving seat, organising everything, trying to get everything together. But she was the personality. Yeah. She was the front person. And likewise, working with Billy and Jimmy, and Billy, you know, it's like you can't work with Billy unless you allow him to be the front person.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And I'm quite happy for him to be the outward projection of L13. And
he's pretty much like bulletproof. You know, no matter what gets thrown at him, it does just deflect away, doesn't it?
Yes, yeah, exactly. Very self-assured and in what he's doing and how he wants to do it, and is immovable on singular path.
L13 has got a mythical quality about it. I was always intrigued with it for I see little bits that L13 are doing. In the back of my mind, I just go, that's fucking genius.
When me and Adam first started doing visual art, and actually we're still recording at the time, as STOT 21st E Plan B, there was an article in Bazaar magazine about us. It must have been at the time of an exhibition and a record that we'd made. And the guy writing it, whose name I can't remember right now, he said, you know, it's like their output swings wildly between genius and unmitigated crap.
And but that's fine.
Yeah, our response to that was, well, you know, it's like genius, unmitigated crap. We don't know which is which.
Yeah.
You know, we maybe the unmitigated crap is the genius bit. I don't know. So, I've always had that relationship where it's not to be judgmental about ours or anybody else's work.
Yeah. You do find with the genre of not giving a fuck, there's so many people who work really hard to try and make it look like they don't give a fuck.
Mm.
And there is a lot of people who just don't give a fuck, and everyone's really shine out.
Yeah. And going back to Billy, and that's what the most singular thing about him that stands apart from nearly any other artist I know is that he has an ability to walk away from what he's done.
Yeah.
So he loves to make a painting, and he loves making the painting, but very, very rarely goes back to it. So he'll do a painting in a day, but he'll very rarely go back and say, what if I change that? It'd be so much better if I did change that, or I'm not that happy with that bit. He doesn't care.
Yeah.
He said, I've done my bit, it exists. I'm more interested in doing another one. And I've never met another artist who can do that so successfully.
And mean it.
And mean it, yeah. And
there's many an artist may do that
just
to make a statement, whereas that's just him, isn't it?
And, you know, I always try, I mean, with Adam, when we were doing more painting, Adam is complete opposite. And I say, Adam, that's done, leave it. And then the next second, what have you done? He said, oh, I couldn't leave it.
Why is it orange?
And then, of course, you'd take photos in it, and you'd look back at how it was before you painted it. And I've done it myself. You know, so I can't leave it like that.
Yeah.
Then you paint over it, or you do something different. And then you find the photo of where I said, why did I change it? It was brilliant before.
This is exactly the conversation I had yesterday with someone. And as well,
artists should just learn to let it go. You know, just stop worrying about it. as long as it's in the studio, it's at risk.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we will.
Yeah, if it's in arm's reach.
Yeah, and, you know, some, my daughter's, she wants some of the paintings that we made a few, we did all these sort of religious scenes, and she's really into all that imagery at the moment. And she found some paintings that she really liked about it. I said, well, can we have one of those in our house?
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, if I can find it. And I've had a good search, and I think we've painted over it. You know, it's... And we will, me and Adam would occasionally drag stuff out and say, because we're running out of space to store it. And so, well, let's paint over these ones.
Yeah.
And yeah, so nothing's safe.
Would you not paint on the back, of on the reverse, so it's a double, artwork?
No. And no, Bill is, he used to work on wooden boards, and there are loads that he did, which he's painted front and back.
Did you ever art in the home growing up?
Yeah. My parents were... both from working class backgrounds, but
and where was this?
So my both were born in Manchester. My granddads were from Manchester. On my mum's side, he was brought up in the slums of Manchester. He was a conscientious objector during the Second World War. Then went to work on the land. Then ended up being a bricklayer, moving south, where he met. Interestingly, met my grandmother at a Communist Party meeting, and she was from a Jewish... She was actually comes from Adam's neck of the wood in Mile End.
Okay.
They were kind of from Polish-Jewish heritage. They'd come over. My great-great-grandfather had been in the Polish cavalry, and they came over at the time of the Russian-Japanese War.
Yeah.
So my parents also met... My dad was treasurer of the Young Communist League, so they met through politics. Wow. When my dad had moved south to get a job, and he met my mum at some meeting. They, you know, it was in the 60s, but they hated rock. They considered rock and roll American decadence.
Yeah,
My dad loved classical music, very reactionary and very conservative in many ways. So when I was growing up, And I think it's partly because I come from a working class family. My granddad, my dad's side, my mum's side, he was one of these guys. He was really keen on education. He self-educated himself. He learned to play the classical guitar, and he painted, and I think this kind of rubbed off on my mum. So I'm sort of first generation middle class, and I grew up. They were very keen on culture. So they would start off with them having prints in the house. When I remember from being a kid, having a print of Guernica on the wall,
wow.
Which would have suited their politics. And
I was
obsessed with this weird painting that was always in the kitchen when I was a kid.
They still got it?
They've got a version. They replaced it. It got, because it was in the kitchen, it started walking.
Of course, yeah,
but
yeah.
They've still got a print of that in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And then my mum, she went to teacher's training course. She started painting through that, and she really developed this love of painting.
Nice.
Kind of, she was, you know, painting, and she always encouraged us to be creative.
Yeah. After listening to the story of your parents and their personalities, that just explains why we're sitting here in a bunker talking about what we're talking
about.
Yeah,
well, exactly. It's like with that kind of political legacy.
Yeah.
Also, because my parents were sort of reactionary and conservative,
yeah.
So my dad hated all the rock music that I listened to. But and I was in full fledged rebellion. So anything to displease my dad was a bonus, as far as I was concerned.
Yeah, well, either the same or the opposite is a reaction
to
your childhood.
And so I was born. But they did have this kind of very strong moral, political, ethical stance on life, which I really, really respected my granddad, my mum's side, particularly with the pacifism and the fact that he wouldn't even play games. He hated competitive games.
Oh, okay.
Because he said it's just ritualised warfare. He was half deaf. He had an accident with a tractor when he was working on the land, and so he'd just sit off by himself in the corner and listen to the radio whilst we'd play Risk and kind of.
So how was he dealing with you when you played up as a child? Outlook.
But my dad.
Yeah.
Well, he was always a bit. He was a real workaholic, which is another thing I've inherited.
Yeah.
Of him, so he wasn't home very often.
Okay.
My mum was a stay-at-home mum, and again, that was a real thing for him. And and I guess they were like, even though they started off as communists, they were like yuppies, really. They were upwardly mobile. They wanted to become middle class, you know. It was very Abigail's Party, you know. They had the sets of Shakespeare and Dickens to show that they were cultured. And he wasn't around very much. He was always working, and it was always, you know, wait till your dad gets home.
Yeah.
So he was like the voice of authority, waiting for him to come home so he could tell you off.
Positive thing in life, I think.
But again, he was, you know, because again, his dad was a joiner and, you know, and run a. Actually, my parents argued. My dad says he's from a working class family, but my mum says he's not, because his dad actually ran his own business. Respinning the mules in the cotton mills, and he said he was self-employed. He wasn't working class, you know. And that's a big difference. But my mum sounds really posh. It was very, you know, it's like, you know, my granddad was from, had a really broad Lancashire accent. My grandma had, you know, real London Cockney accent, and she speaks like the Queen. And she was raised in Sussex. You know, I think again the idea of getting bettering yourself was to adopt all these attributes that you associate with being better off or being of
and
a higher class.
That's almost turned around now, hasn't it?
Yeah,
People try to dumb their
exactly.
Their middle class down.
Because imagine it's like having parents who come from working class background, and all my relatives are in that area, but I was sent to elocution lessons and I was brought up to sound posh.
Wow.
So I was bullied at school for being posh. And I said, that's not fair. And I ended up going to a boarding school. And the first thing, I was bullied more there for sounding posh than so. Even I've spent a lot of time trying to dampen down, you know, that side of my accent, trying to sound a little bit more London. You know, I've been in, you know, I lived in London for 20 years, hanging out with Adam, trying to sound more like him.
Well, I spoke to an artist a little while ago, a guy called Opaque, like an urban artist. He had a similar background. His mum and dad were from East London, working class. Ended up owning a few high street galleries, wanted to better themselves and the chain that they're creating, so sent him off to a private school. And just like you said, he got bullied there for being a bit of an oik, you know, and his other friends started bullying him because he was going to this posh school, and he was in this sort of like limbo area of not knowing where he was as a child.
But as it turned out, the boarding school I went to, it was this place called Abbotsholm, and it had been started at the turn of the 20th century when there were a lot of radical ideas around what education should be. And it had a farm on the school, and they did a lot of stuff like climbing, you know, mountain climbing and outward stuff, and also really big on art stuff. And I was really into animals. At that point, I wasn't sure whether I was going to be involved with art or animals. I really liked the fact they had a farm there.
Yeah.
And my dad called it a school for middle-class dropouts. And they were very, you know, they were really light on rules, and, you know, it was you know, considered progressive.
Brilliant.
Whereas my brother went to Repton, which was like a proper public school.
Yeah.
And my sister ended up coming to my school, but she went to an all-girls school in Bexhill, which was very Edwardian. And it's weird that we all decided to go to separate schools.
And what do your siblings do now?
My sister's a teacher working with little children. And my brother's an engineer. He's actually, interestingly, my brother's complete opposite of me. My dad was the first in his family to go to university. And he went to Leeds University and studied chemical engineering. And my brother, he was a bit of an odd kid. He was bullied quite badly at school, and he was a bit of an oddball. And he was desperate to get approval from my dad the whole time. And he ended up going to Leeds University and studying chemical engineering, which I've thought, that is just too weird.
Yeah.
And still, he still didn't get my dad's approval. So
your dad's bar was quite high then.
Yeah, well, my dad happened. My parents actually came to a private view of us. Me and Adam did a Harry Adams show in this gallery called Airspace in Stoke-on-Trent. It's a great little, it's an artist-run space, run by this guy called Glenn, whose surname I forget right now. And and it's just really healthily run community gallery space. And, you know, we like working with Glenn up there, and we did this exhibition. And my parents came to the opening, and they came all the way up to Stoke and stayed in local, and they came along, and they were talking to Glenn, the director of the gallery, and he said, "Oh, you must be very proud of Steve." And you know, and I was standing there, and they went, and apparently, so Glenn told me later, so they came up to my mum came up to him and said, "So we are proud. We just don't like to say anything in front of him." So, yeah, so that's... And I also remember when we were in a band, we got a single of the week in Melody Maker from the thing we brought out. And for some reason, it was there must have been some kind of family gathering. And it was quite shortly after we'd got this, you know. And so my sister was really pleased for us. She said, "Dad, you know, aren't you proud of Steve? He's got a single of the week." He went, "No." So why are you impressed with that?
Yeah, what more do you want?
Yeah,
from
like, yeah, I think you said something like, "So what, they take turns to get that."
Fucking hell.
So, yeah, so, but, you know, it has made me try very hard. But, you know, like I said, I was more into, you know, rebelling and doing things that I didn't need approval for. And I think it's something that I'm very aware that Billy had a very kind of difficult childhood. Yeah. And again, his brother was always trying to seek approval of his dad, and Billy had decided that he wasn't going to try and do that. And I think there is something about self-acknowledgement. You know, it's like, I'm doing what I want to do in the way that I want to do it, and that is my aim. You know, I'm not too interested
and
in...
And that is breaking the shackles, isn't
it? And I'm not into... you know, it's nice when people... When I get a pat on the head, you know, but I don't need it. You know, it's I'm not hungry for that.
Yeah.
I'm hungry for doing what I think I should be doing and doing it in the way that I think it should be done.
Perfect. And so that's how I see L13. Is that what you just said there?
There you go. I'm going to stop it there. As I mentioned in the intro, this episode was just over an hour and a half long, so I wanted to divide it into two just to make it that little bit easier to digest. The second half will be out in a couple of days, although if you're a Patreon supporter, as I said in the intro, shoot over to the Patreon page and the second half is sitting there waiting for you. Either way, I'll see you in part two. Well, hope you enjoyed that episode of the Ministry of Arts podcast. So we wasn't dictated to by advertisers, we decided from the offset to go ad-free, which means obviously we had to self-fund. So we set up the Ministry of Arts Patreon page. And without that support, we would not be able to produce this podcast. So if you like what you hear and you're able to support the podcast, just go over to the Ministry of Arts Instagram profile. You'll find a Linktree drop-down box, which will direct you straight to our Patreon page. And for the price of a cup of coffee, you can help keep us growing week by week. But if you're not able to do that, that's fine, because this content is free for everyone. But leaving a review on whichever platform you listen to your podcast, that really does help us get noticed and anyone else looking for an art podcast. Or even giving us a positive shout out on your social media. Everything is appreciated. But either way, thanks for listening. And until next week, ta-da.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.